In the late 18th century, a Hungarian inventor named Wolfgang von Kempelen dazzled the Austrian court with a robot he created called the Turk. The Turk played chess. It operated autonomously, or so it seemed, and it was a very skillful player. Now, when it was presented to the Empress Maria Theresa, she remarked on how incredibly lifelike the robot was.
Das ist ja unglaublich. Dieser Roboter sieht aus wie ein Mensch.
Which translates into English as, how incredibly lifelike this robot is. Actually, I have no idea what the Empress thought or said, but the Turk did impress people, and many people thought it was real. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. As you've no doubt guessed, the Turk was an elaborate hoax. But today, there are software programs that can play an excellent game of chess, and all sorts of machines and robots that have enormous skill. In many ways, software and robotics have advanced way beyond human capacity. They're capable of astounding mathematical calculation, for instance, and they can work all day and all night without the need for rest. But there are many areas, such as dexterity and instinctive creativity, in which robots and programs still lag behind. Making them more like us is a threatening proposition for some, but it's crucial if machines are to fulfil their promise. So, creating machines that are more like us, that's the overall theme of today's program. And we start today with Associate Professor Mari Velanaki, the Director of the Creative Robotics Lab at the University of New South Wales, whose recent research questions the stereotype that Western cultures are wary of robots.
It's a study that we ran in Tokyo and Sydney. So 112 people in Tokyo from different age groups, from 19 to around 69, 71, and the same number in Sydney. And what we found out that the Japanese would trust the robot more, but the Australians like the robot more. So the Japanese like the robot less as the interaction progressed, but the Australians actually find it more fascinating and they wanted to interact longer. So although they didn't trust it at the same level, they were much more interested and in favour it and wanted to spend more time interacting with it.
And that finding is very different from the conventional wisdom about the acceptance of robots within Western as opposed to Japanese society. It's important to point out that Dr. Velanaki's research was done using an android-style robot called a Geminoid. So one that's been created to look and talk like a real person, in this case a young Japanese woman. And participants were called on to rate the robot on likability, perceived intelligence and perceived safety. So how does Dr. Velanaki interpret the result?
I would think that Japanese, they're more in contact with robots, or at least not even with real robots, but within their culture, there's more discussion and there's a big investment in social robotics and robots that they appear in different events, so they would trust more the technology. In Australia, I think they liked the, I'm not sure if they like the robots more, but they like the experimental nature of the conversation, the playfulness and the fact that they could explore more. So I think the element of playfulness in the conversation, maybe that's something that the Australians liked more. They liked the actual experience. I don't know if it was the robot or that particular robot, because you say it's very hard to generalize. We talk about a very specific robot, Hiroshi Ishiguro, the Geminoid that we use for this experiment. Something that we didn't write on the paper that we published is that what I found interesting, there's this kind of trust exercise that the Geminoid asks during the experiment, the participant is one-to-one, to move a box closer to her and then closer and closer. And in Japan, people just did that. They moved the box or just do whatever object we had there closer and closer to her. I say her because it's a female representation. Many people, though, although it wasn't part of the study, what we've noticed during the interaction, many people in Australia ask the robot why. So they ask why before they did something. And when the robot responded, because I can't walk, then they did it. So I thought that the questioning part was interesting before they did the task.
Mari Velanaki from the University of New South Wales. Better understanding the nuances of robot-human interaction is crucial in the further development of what's called social robotics. That is, the development of robots as carers or companions. Robots, for instance, that might be able to assist the elderly or the infirm in the future. If a robot isn't likeable or trusted, it can't properly perform its task. And if it's clumsy...
Oops, I am such a butterfingers, I just dropped your antique vase.
Well, if it's clumsy, according to Professor Michael Beetz, then it's also going to be limited in its functionality.
I would pick it up, but my fingers don't seem to work that well.
Professor Beetz is the head of the Institute for Artificial Intelligence at the University of Bremen in Germany.
So the reason that people usually don't see these kinds of problems is that people usually do manipulation tasks like getting a bottle of water, opening it, pouring it, and they do it on a daily basis without even thinking about it, right? And the other thing is that robots that are capable of doing manipulation tasks, they are shown in all science fiction movies, right? But if you look at what is involved in doing a simple manipulation task, say if a robot gets a task, pour some water into the glass, right? So there are many pieces of information missing. So the robot would have to know that the water is inside the bottle. It would have to know how to grasp the bottle, right? So it would grasp the bottle in different ways, depending on whether it wants to fill a glass or whether it wants to put it down on the floor. It has to reason about where to stand in order to pick up the bottle, where to hold the bottle, how much to tilt the bottle, what effects you expect when you pour some water into a glass. And those are all skills that we have because those kinds of actions are part of our everyday activities. But if we want to program robots, we have to show them everything in every little detail and program that, or kind of we have to equip these robots somehow with this kind of knowledge.
So just so I'm clear, I mean, it's easy to program a robot to do a specific task, but it's much more difficult to get that robot to a stage where it can autonomously decide how best to undertake a task. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and that is the reason why robots are successful in factories. And this is because they have highly repetitive tasks and the environment is actually built for the robot tasks to be simple. But as soon as we get out of the factory environment and into more open domains, the whole complexity of our everyday life gets confronted, or the robots get confronted with all that complexity.
And this is important because we want robots in the future to be doing tasks around the home, within institutions, say with healthcare, all of those kind of things, the sort of tasks that will involve quite high-level manipulation, don't we?
Yes, so I think in particular in the context of aging societies, robots can play a very important role, right? If you think about people who are disabled, they have to wait at home for caregivers to come, and then they have to ask just to get a simple object, right? But if those people would have robots at home as a tool, so they could kind of get any object they need at any time and without asking anybody for help, right? So that would raise the level of independence, in particular of people who can't leave the bed, tremendously.
I understand that robots also struggle with understanding depth or perceiving things like glass or transparency with objects. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. There's a rule of thumb, right? So the kinds of capabilities that humans have and that they are the oldest in the evolutionary history, they are typically kind of the hardest to develop on robots. And this is because kind of through evolution, a lot of advanced is basically hidden in the human capabilities, and writing programs that have the same kind of capabilities is unbelievably hard and complex.
So one solution that Michael Beetz and others have come up with is to develop an online repository, a one-stop shop of instructions for how to make robots more agile and dexterous. It's being funded by the European Union, and it's called RoboHow.
So RoboHow is an exploratory project, so it explores what are possible techniques that enable robots to read instructions from the web, to complement that information they read about with kind of videos that show the same kind of activities, and use the combination of knowledge in order to partly automatically derive parts of robot control programs to perform these tasks.
So if I had a robot, say I was developing a robot and it was having problems with a manipulation task, say pouring a glass of water, the example that you'd given, then the robot could itself access this archive, if you like, called RoboHow, and learn from that how to actually go about the task. So in one way, it's almost like a Wikipedia for robots, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So it's like a Wikipedia and kind of an instruction website for robots, yes.
Now, this research is only in its early stages. How long do you think it will take to construct this kind of repository for robots, RoboHow?
It largely depends on how many people would contribute to such repositories, right? So one would start with actually building such repositories for narrow domains. So for instance, something like chemical experiments or industrial assembly, and then one would widen it. But I think for those narrow domains, that could be actually feasible in a number of years, so say 5 years, 6 years, that you have a substantial coverage that you can perform such activities based on instructions.
And that that involvement of other robotics researchers is important, isn't it? Because this is a project that is open to other roboticists. It's not just a project that's being kept in-house by your institution.
Yes, I think the only way, so it's like Wikipedia, as you said, right? You need people to contribute knowledge nuggets from all different domains and make them accessible to others so that you can kind of have a coverage of knowledge domains that is necessary for reaching the necessary capability of performing manipulation actions.
Michael Beetz from the University of Bremen.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a scientist.
Eureka! A scientist. I think science is so amazing. Why do you want to be a scientist?
I always really liked chemistry and physics in school.
The study of physics is incredible. Take gravity. You can't see it, but the second you trip, it's right there to pull you down. Did you ever fall or trip on something? It happens to me all the time. That's gravity, pulling you down, sometimes with an ouch.
She's indefatigably cheery, and as you just heard, she's interested in science. But Michael Beetz, take note, she's also a bit clumsy. And if you're thinking she sounds a bit like a Barbie doll, that's because she is one.
You know, some of the most interesting life on Earth is too small to be seen without a microscope. Have you ever looked through a microscope?
Yeah, quite a few times.
Barbie is having a discussion here with a fully grown man, a reporter for CNET. This particular interactive model, Hello Barbie, is not just a plastic doll that can talk. It's a plastic doll linked to a very clever piece of interactive software developed by a company called ToyTalk. ToyTalk's CEO and co-founder is Oren Jacob, the former chief technology officer for the animation studio Pixar.
The ToyTalk technology that we've built we call Pull String, like you pull the string of a marionette puppet, if you will. And that enables us to create and deliver a believable conversation with a character that we craft as writers. In this case, that's a doll, Barbie, as presented to the customer as a Wi-Fi connected play experience. And she has a microphone and speaker inside of her and enough electronics in her torso to get a secure Wi-Fi connection from the doll to your local house Wi-Fi network and then to the internet where our servers are. Her belt buckle is a microphone button, and you press and hold it to talk to her like you would a walkie-talkie. So when you're pressing down the belt buckle and hold it and say, "Hello, Barbie, how are you?" the microphone in the Barbie doll captures what you said, sends that over Wi-Fi to your house and off to the internet to our servers. We process that speech to understand what you said. We decide what Barbie should say back, and she's, of course, a pleasant conversationalist, as you imagine Barbie would be. And so we might say, "I'm fine, how are you?" And we stream that audio from our servers in the cloud back down to the doll, and then the speaker in the doll, presents that sound that a child is playing, and you hear Barbie say, "I'm fine, how are you?" And that's sort of one turn of the conversational loop.
Now, some people I know full well are not going to like the idea of a wired Barbie or any type of wired toy. And there are legitimate concerns about privacy and hacking of conversations, etc., with any type of technology that involves microphones and voice recognition. But in that regard, Hello Barbie is little different to Apple's smartphone assistant Siri. And while she's not strictly a robot, Hello Barbie is designed as a piece of social software, social technology, to keep children amused and to provide an interactive experience. So how many responses or conversational variants is Hello Barbie capable of?
That's a great question. And for us, that's one of the sort of the main differences between Hello Barbie and previous attempts at conversational dolls or toys. Previously, you might get, you know, a dozen or, I don't know, 50 or something, you know, different recordings in a doll if you bought a fancy one. We're coming to market with thousands and thousands of them. I think at this point we're talking about 8,000 and change are already in the doll at launch, and more can be added as we go forward as well, too. So you can talk to her for hours and hours and hours at a time and not repeat anything at all. And we do our best also to surface new content and new things to talk about as you play with Barbie more. It's one of the key features of our technology. Our goal really is believable conversation, and our company here is not trying to recreate exactly how a human would talk back. It's a little different than that. We try to understand how conversation works and characterize that, but we give that to our writing team to really craft how Barbie, who's a fictional character, how would she speak and what would she talk about and what would she know about and what would she not know about. So for us, it's most important that when kids play with Hello Barbie, they believe that she's speaking back to them and that it's an enjoyable experience and they want to talk to her more. But the goal is not really to make it a, you know, audio real experience indistinguishable from a human. It's just to characterize, caricature and design conversation so that Barbie can speak in what her voice would be if a toy really, really could talk to you.
Now, voice recognition is important as part of this in order to make the interactions work smoothly. How difficult is it to achieve effective voice recognition when you're dealing with very small children?
Yeah, it's quite difficult. Almost all of the development done in speech recognition has been for adults. And by that, I mean post-puberty and in an age range 13 and above. There are laws here in the United States, COPPA in particular, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, that segregates how data is handled 13 and above and 13 and below. So all the big speech companies have worked on the adult challenge, and you see that expressed in Siri and Google Now and Cortana and Xbox and Alexa and the various products out there today. To work in the kids' space is very different. So first there's the compliance space of how to handle the data differently, which we also do. But this the speech recognition engineering and research challenge specifically, children speak differently than adults, and they sound different than adults. They use different words than adults, different emphasis, different accents. They're more variable than adults, even in the same geographic location. And so, Toy Talk at this point is the world leader in natural language understanding of children's speech, and we work with the best partners in the world to develop this raw recognition for children's spoken language, which is never done before. That's a completely new field.
Oren Jacob at Toy Talk in the United States. Oh, and thank you, Barbie.
My full name is Barbara Millicent Roberts, but you can call me Barbie. Is there anything else you want to ask? Talk to you later.
Millicent. Now, with her love of science, I wouldn't be surprised if Barbie's a regular Future Tense listener, but I hope she's not listening to this next bit. Hello Barbie is a clever and sophisticated piece of interactive software, but she's not creative. Cruel, but true. Her interactions are ultimately determined by a team of human writers responding and adapting to the questions asked of her by children. But there are those working in the field of artificial intelligence who believe that it is possible to make software that is instinctively creative. Professor Simon Colton is a professor of what's called computational creativity at Goldsmiths College at the University of London.
Well, it's the art, science and philosophy of getting software to take creative responsibility in certain projects, whether those projects are in the arts or in sciences or in finance or in design, it doesn't really matter. The real question is, how can we hand over creative responsibility to software? And that obviously is a subfield of artificial intelligence. We tend to use AI techniques and innovate with AI techniques in order to get software to be more creative. And it means often quite the antithesis of normal computing, which is, with normal computing, you want software to do exactly what you've told it to do, be reliable and be certified and everything. So if you're flying in an aeroplane, you want that software to do exactly what it was meant to do. And in computational creativity, we're more interested in whether we can get software to genuinely surprise us by either doing something interesting or creating something interesting, or preferably both. And in the last few years, we've started moving away from getting software to just output particular artifacts associated with human creative behavior. So that's what we've been doing in the last 10, 15 years, getting software to generate poems, getting software to generate pieces of visual art or video games. And certainly in my group, we're more interested now in simulating creative behavior, regardless really of whether the output is interesting or not. Ideally, you can simulate creative behavior and produce things which are culturally valuable, but we're kind of concentrating on whether it's feasible and a natural thing to do, to actually point at software and describe it with behaviors associated with creativity.
And one of those behaviors being the ability to paint and draw. The Painting Fool is a recent project that Simon and his colleagues have been working on, involving the development of a very sophisticated software system, programmed with an understanding of things like mood and colour and the skills to paint and draw. When it feels like being artistic, the software then autonomously chooses a certain style and look for each piece of art it creates, and it self-evaluates the completed artwork in order to improve. Simon Colton again.
The stated goal of this project is for the software to be taken seriously as a creative artist in its own right one day. The line is, when I die, no one will notice because the software will just carry on painting pictures in thought-provoking way, learning, discovering, and being an artist. So the question is, can we bring into existence a piece of software which the art world, art critics, the general public will think of as being an artist? And can we make it a creative artist? And it's our job to try and program the software so that it does things that we haven't explicitly asked it to do in advance, so that we can't tell what it's going to do. And in this instance, it does, because I never have any sense of whether it's going to be in a good mood or a bad mood, what painting style it's going to choose, what abstract art it's going to put in the background, what image filter it's going to do, what painting style it's going to apply. And I also don't know how it's going to feel about the portrait produced at the end. I've done about 200 portraits now. And over that time, I've not programmed it directly to learn that if it wants to produce a bleary portrait, it should focus on pencils and very muted colours and a kind of a neat but sparing painting style. But it's learned that for itself. So in answer to the question, isn't this just programming and it does exactly what you want it to do? That's true only at one level. At another level, as I said earlier, I've got no idea whether it's going to even paint a portrait when someone sits down in front of it, never mind what kind of portrait or what it's going to feel about that portrait. And as it's evolving over time with every new portrait, I don't know in advance what style it's going to choose or what it's going to say about that. So it's our job in computational creativity to try and hand over the creative responsibility. We call this climbing the meta mountain, constantly asking ourselves, what is it that we are contributing creatively to this project, and how can we get the software to do that in our stead?
Simon Colton and his Painting Fool. And I should mention that the software's artworks have now been exhibited in both Britain and France. Elsewhere in the UK, in Cambridge in fact, another scientist has also been pushing the boundaries of creative robotics. Fumiya Iida is with the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University, and his focus has been on mimicking the act of life itself, a robot that can reproduce.
We are interested in what we call evolutionary robotics, where we're trying to understand the process of nature by building robots. So in our research, we built a system consisting of a mother robot that operates some materials from the environment to put them together so that they can construct the child robots. But the mother robot can build hundreds of child robots so that she can try and errors what design is better. So by repeating this process, says mother robot can improve design of child robot over generations, and that can be regarded as a creativity of mother robot.
Which does sound in a way like a survival of the fittest form of robotic creativity. The aim of the selection process is to create new offspring robots that have improved mobility.
So this is not exactly natural selection as in nature. It's a bit different, an engineered version of natural selection in the sense that, you know, our robots don't exactly self-reproduce like animals, right? We are able to self-reproduce, but robots cannot. The aspect we're looking at the moment in our research is the fact that the making a lot of prototypes, testing it, and improve the prototypes based on the testing is actually very important. So we are not, the robot itself is not self-reproducing, but robots are making a lot of different kind of robots and analyze the performance of them so that the mother robot can have some intuition or understanding about what good and what bad with respect to certain criteria. And what we are looking at in, as a criteria here is the locomotion capability, like how a robot can move around in a better way. So the mother robot builds many different kind of robots, the child robots doing locomotion, and looking at which one do a better job in terms of locomotion, and then improve the pick up the design of the good children and then improve the design of them.
And how successful has the mother robot been at, I guess, building stronger or building more efficient offspring?
So at the beginning, obviously the mother robot has no idea about what robots are, what child robots are, what locomotion are. And so basically the mother robot tried to build something very random, you know, designs. And at the beginning, the child robots don't do much, just, you know, moving around without any success. But after building hundreds of robots, actually the largest experiment we did so far is 500, the construction of 500 child robots, and see how child robots improve after all these trials and errors. So far, we are very happy that mother robot came up with a pretty good solution for locomotion of child robots. And we observed about up to 400-500% of the improvement of locomotion, which basically means that, you know, the robot moves 5 centimeters at the beginning, but after 500 experiments, you can see robot that can move over 50 centimeters and so on, the given time period. So that's the kind of scale we're looking at the moment.
And importantly, the mother robot has undertaken this selection and development process without help, without ongoing help from programmers.
So that's exactly the point. So we are trying to exclude as much human intervention as possible and see how robots can be creative just like ourselves. And of course, you know, the robot's creativity is not as great as human designers, but this is a first step toward how we can make our robots more creative rather than repeating same thing again and again in those robots in the factories.
And if you're worried about where all this robotic creativity is heading, particularly with robots being developed to create their own offspring, just remember, for the moment at least, they're still very clumsy. Fumiya Iida there from Cambridge University. We also heard today from Simon Colton at the University of London, Oren Jacob at the company ToyTalk in the US, Michael Beats from the University of Bremen, and Mari Velanaki at the University of New South Wales. And a footnote that Professor Velanaki has been appointed the director of a new multi-university research initiative called the National Facility for Human-Robotic Interaction. And the centre is due to be launched in June next year. Thanks to co-producer Karin Savanovitz and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
The Arts Channel on ABC iView.
What are we looking for today?
What we want to find.
A world of art and culture at your fingertips.
I know when I'm going to write a song. I just get a feeling that I'm going to write a song.
Design, documentaries, film, books, music, interviews, fashion.
We like to think of it as a talking show.
Discover the arts in all its forms.
From feature films to web series to video art.
The Arts Channel on ABC iView, where life and culture collide.